Thank you. And thank you to Al McCoy, who's given you an excellent introduction to the seriousness of the problem. I don't know why, Jerry, you said that you were almost apologetic for talking about drugs at the beginning of this series. I think that's exactly where it should be at the very beginning, because since World War II, America has become an empire. Its defense establishment has become an offense establishment. And the whole thesis of my most recent prose book, American War Machine, is that that terrible transformation of America from a democracy into an empire was achieved by the drug traffic. And I would like to supplement, before I start my written remarks, supplement the statistics that Al gave you about what happened in Afghanistan between 1980, 100 tons, negligible in the world market at the time, and zero really in the United States. And then 1 year or 2 years later, 60% of the drugs in America, and then skyrocketing from 100 tons in 1980 to 8,200 tons in 2006. So it's not just that America and the CIA have latched into something that is there, it has virtually created the global drug traffic that we are dealing with today. And I'll skip Colombia and Latin America, but I will go back to the beginning of all this. Before the Golden Crescent, we had the Golden Triangle. And that's where this all began, in Thailand and Burma. And this was another area which, before we got there, had been marginal in the global market. And the estimates are maybe about 40 tons a year of opium before World War II. And then by the height of the Vietnam War, it was something like 1,200 tons a year. Now, those figures are not as big as what happened later in Afghanistan. But if you put them together, you see this sort of continuous growth, and the growth is always where the CIA is backing armies. Now, why would this happen? And there's a very poignant anecdote in Al McCoy's book. By the way, before I go any further, I want to praise Al McCoy's book, The Politics of Heroin, as it is now called, because it is the Bible in this field, and it has served more than any other book to wake up at least some congressmen and some American politicians to the fact that we have a very major problem here. It's a problem domestically for what it's doing to our cities. It's a problem internationally for what it has done to create mercenary armies wherever we have gone, and to establish networks which are deleterious all over the place. And in 1980, when Carter was still president, you had a man there called David Mustow, who was charged to deal with the domestic aspect of the opium problem. And he became aware that Zbigniew Brzezinski and the CIA were beginning to... this is before the Soviets... I said 1980, but it actually began before the Soviets thing. The Soviet invasion was Christmas 1979. Brzezinski and the CIA were active from 1978. And as Brzezinski later boasted, he was doing this to draw the Soviets in. He wanted it because he said, as when they did invade, he said to Carter, now we will give the Soviets their Vietnam War. In other words, a tragedy. It was a tragedy for the Soviet Union and contributed to the breakup of the Soviet Union. Unfortunately, in giving the Soviet Union another Vietnam War, the legacy after that was to give us another Vietnam War too. And I can't believe how Brzezinski was willing to boast about this as late as 1998, but he did, to a French newspaper. And Al McCoy's book has woken us up to this. But we have this problem of a continuous growth, and the growth is where the CIA is active. And so we have seen this transformation of America. into an empire, and I would just quote what Senator Fulbright said in a lecture after his retirement, the price of empire is America's soul, and that is too high a price. And if we want to get America's soul back, we have to do something to dismantle the empire, and if we want to do something to dismantle all these bases all over the world and everything, we have to get far more American consciousness than there is at present about the central role of the drug traffic in building up this offensive capacity and the our need, therefore, to do something about it. Now, I was going to, Al, I think you said some things today which are, go way beyond what you said in your book, and I'm not going to waste time now criticizing your book because I think you've given us a good picture here. But I want to say this, I want to start with a quote from not Al's book, but another of Al's books. Most well-developed heroin networks very quickly move towards a complementation of interests between the narcotics traffickers and corrupt elements of the enforcement agencies responsible for the suppression of the illicit drug trade. I think that's profoundly true. It's illustrated domestically with the corruption of the FBN, old Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which became considerable towards the end, corruption of DEA, and but above all, corruption of CIA, because why is all this going on? And why is somebody like Musto not listened to, frozen out, forbidden by the CIA to see the secret documents that he was actually entitled to see in terms of his office? Well, I think this symbiosis dates back to the British Empire, when back in 1838, opium was the number one commodity traded in the world, and that was because of a triangular trade in the British Empire where opium essentially paid for the tea that went to England, tea, and the tea paid for the commodities went back to India, and the tax on tea paid for the British Navy. Now, in my book, American War Machine, I describe how American involvement in the Southeast Asian opium narco-economy was preceded by the mysterious activities in Thailand of something called the World Commerce Corporation. This was a private group of Anglo-American millionaires, including Sir William Stevenson, Sir Victor Sassoon, Nelson Rockefeller, and former OSS chief William Donovan. I suspect but cannot prove that in this way the old drug connection which financed the British Empire and created the fortunes of what is now HSBC and the Sassoon family evolved into what I call clumsily today's global CIA drug connection. Just as Britain used profits from drugs to pay for the administration of Malaya and other colonies in the 19th century, so since 1950, the CIA has relied on drugs to finance proxy armies it could not otherwise pay for. And I was then going to criticize your book, but maybe you would agree with that statement now, I'm not sure. If you don't, I'll say some more.
We're going to have a rebuttal.
First thing I would say, in an indirect sense. In other words,
yes, we both would say in an indirect sense.
It's not like the French, where they actually ran the traffic and financed their covert operation. But it's all.
No, but the CIA counted on the drugs to be there to pay for the army that it could not itself pay for.
It amplified the whole operation.
If we have agreement on that, I won't waste too much time, but I do want to say that the CIA, starting in Operation Paper in 1950, that's what they called it, to support the Kuomintang Chinese Nationalist Drug Proxy Army in Burma, supplied the necessary arms, equipment, and planes to move arms in and also to move the drugs out, and it counted on the army's drug trafficking to raise the cash to support the army because they knew that Congress was not going to provide the cash to pay for a drug-growing army in Burma. It's as simple as that. So the CIA created a huge infrastructure for a succession of at least five successive drug proxy armies that were financed by involvement in drug trafficking. Of these, the KMT troops in Burma is the best documented. We know it was armed and supported by two CIA proprietaries, Sea Supply Inc. and the airline CAT, which later became notorious as Air America. But the CIA, the KMT became irrelevant as a fighting force, but the CIA continued to build up Sea Supply and Air America to support two more drug proxy armies. First, a drug-financed paramilitary force called PARU in Thailand, and then, after PARU invaded Laos, the Air America continued to support the Hmong army in Laos, headed by General Van Pau. Then by 1975, the CIA pulled out of Laos, but we got the continuity, which I won't repeat, that you heard just starting 5 years later in Pakistan. Now, what about Al? You also said, this is a quote from your book, should I deal with it? The CIA's role in the heroin traffic was an inadvertent consequence of its Cold War tactics. I don't think it was an inadvertent consequence. I think it was a very deliberate, intentional measure to sort of create a capitalism in Southeast Asia that would be able to compete with the communism of mainland China. Would you still say it was an inadvertent consequence?
I guess I would use the metaphor of turning a blind eye. Okay, these are covert warriors. They're military focused. They're instrumental. They're trying to mobilize an effective force with the available resources. And if it's drugs, well, so be it.
He said he would use the metaphor of turning a blind eye. I want to have a frank conversation here without giving you a false impression that I don't respect McCoy's work. McCoy's work is absolutely essential to what we're doing here. But I don't like I'm a poet, and I don't like bad metaphors, and I think that the blind eye, frankly, is a bad metaphor. To begin with, when the CIA went back into Afghanistan in 2001, and this is entirely consistent with what you just told us, they went with the British MI6 to Dijon, France, found an old drug trafficker who had retired, he was an Afghan, but he had left Afghanistan and had reestablished himself in Burgundy, and they told him to come back to Afghanistan and be part of the Northern Alliance drive to get rid of the Taliban. That doesn't sound like turning a blind eye. That sounds like turning your good eye, if you have a good eye. And another example of not turning a blind eye would be the CIA-approved operation, this is cocaine now, with General Ramon Guillen Davila, chief of a CIA-created anti-drug unit in Venezuela, who eventually was indicted in Miami for smuggling a ton of cocaine into the United States. This is not small potatoes here. According to the New York Times, the CIA, over the objections of the Drug Enforcement Administration, approved the shipment of at least one ton of pure cocaine to Miami International Airport. According to the Wall Street Journal, the total amount of drugs smuggled by General Guillen may have been more than 22 tons. But the United States never asked for Guillen's extradition from Venezuela to stand trial. And in 2007, when he was arrested in Venezuela for plotting to assassinate President Hugo Chavez, his indictment was still sealed in Miami, so nothing had ever been done about it. Meanwhile, CIA officer Mark McFarlane, whom the DEA had wished to indict, was never indicted at all. He merely resigned. And if we needed more, I don't know if we'll have a debate about this or not, but if you want more examples, another would be the 1967 Opium War in Laos, which most of you probably haven't heard of, so I'll pass over it for now. So all of this raises the question with who was ultimately behind the U.S. decision in 2001 to back Afghan drug traffickers of the Northern Alliance with the assistance of other known drug-tainted agencies, such as Pakistan's notorious intelligence service, the ISI. Was it a purely political decision, or was it perhaps because it was necessary to give another boost to the narcotics traffic? I want you to think about that. Let us ask first who was ultimately behind the U.S. decision in 1950 through Operation Paper to back the KMT drug proxy army in Burma. This was a U.S. government operation pushed hard for by the Office of Policy Coordination, OPC, only just been created in 1948, and it quickly became the covert operations arm of the CIA, but it was not yet that in 1950. But I suspect the decision to give arms to the army merely ratified a supply operation that had begun much earlier, before OPC had even been created in June 1948. The key figure was an OSS veteran in Bangkok named Willis Byrd, and the question is, who backed Willis Byrd in his operations before OPC began? I believe it was probably the World Commerce Corporation, the same group who backed Willis Byrd's close friend and ally in Bangkok, Jim Thompson, the last OSS chief in wartime Bangkok. We know that Thompson's Thai Silk Company was funded by the World Commerce Corporation of Stevenson and Donovan, and there are reports also that the WCC was spending funds from the SS Gold recovered after World War II by the OSS in Operation Safe Haven, the gold which the SS had hidden in Austria. And it is now known that in December 1947, the National Security Council created a special procedures group that, among other things, laundered over 10 million in captured Axis funds to influence the Italian election of 1948. I believe that the other things besides the Italian election were the buildup of some kind of force that would be able to stop communist expansion from mainland China into Southeast Asia, which they were very worried about at that time because most of the cities of Southeast Asia, right into Jakarta in Indonesia, have very substantial Chinese populations. Al McCoy writes about how a key figure behind the Willis Byrd operation was Paul Helliwell, an OSS veteran, along with Willis Byrd, from the OSS station in Kunming, China, who arranged with the head of OPC, Frank Wisner, to set up the CIA proprietary airline CAT. But Helliwell was not just an intelligence bureaucrat. Actually, at the time, he was an IAMI lawyer and banker, and at some point, the business and financial world of Paul Helliwell began to overlap very strikingly with the financial world of Meyer Lansky and the Mafia. So that raises the question of who was Helliwell really working for? Was he working for the OPC and the CIA and the government, or was he working for the underworld? Now, Helliwell's banking partner was a man called E.P. Barry. And he had been the post-war head of OSS counterintelligence, or X2, in Vienna, which oversaw the recovery of the SS Gold in Operation Safe Haven. So that SS Gold seems to be coming in from two ends, from the World Commerce Corporation first, and from the Helliwell banking operation second. And I suspect that really, Helliwell never became a rich man. He's not personally profiting about this, out of this. And when the CIA sent a man called Bill Lehr, a rather admirable man, actually, I've read his oral history, and I was very impressed with him. He was the head of this Paru unit, and he confesses that they financed their operations by drugs in Thailand. But he didn't become rich. He retired to Texas. I think they were working for this symbiosis that we talked about, between which I would redefine not as just corrupt elements in the enforcement agencies, but between the drug traffic and those people in high power who use them to expand American influence in places like Southeast Asia, where until then it had been notoriously weak, and where also, I have to mention at least, there was known to be considerable resources of offshore oil, which American oil companies wanted to develop. So the three big commodities trafficked in the world today are in order: oil, number one; arms, number two; drugs, number three. I think I've done my 15 minutes, haven't I? Yes, I better stop. And I'll just say all those three commodities are interrelated, because we pay for our Saudi oil by shipping billions of arms to Saudi Arabia every year. And in all of the cases, until maybe this one, the channels that take the CIA arms into the army are the same channels that bring the drugs out. So I'll stop there, and we'll start to debate and then open to questions.
Well, you know,